This is Hearing Voices, brought to you by NPR, with help from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. Welcome to Stars and Bars, a Hearing Voices tribute to summertime in America. I'm Larry Massett. In a minute, we'll be going to a parade. Later on, we'll have a picnic. But first, summer being the patriotic time of year, let's belt out the Pledge of Allegiance.
The Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the United States of America, from whom we stand. I can't remember any of it.
And to the Republic for which she stands.
Yeah, man. I had to memorize that. I had to grow up knowing that.
Of course, you had to stand with your hand over your heart, like little soldiers.
I spent 10 years in the Green Beret, including Vietnam, and I got to where I'd look up and see an American flag. Man, that was a real experience. Still is. Still has.
As far as it having any meaning or anything to me, it doesn't. None at all.
We're not a melting pot, because you cannot take all the cultures that are here in the United States of America and throw them into one pot and come out with a quote-unquote un-American.
I grew up on a ranch in eastern Oregon, a place called Roseburg.
I was born in Puerto Rico, a small little town called Mayagüez.
Atlanta, Georgia.
Washington, D.C.
I'm with the Mandan Hidatsa, Fort Berthold Indian Reservation.
I'm from the north of England, Yorkshire.
400 kilometers west of Istanbul.
The day I became a citizen, I had someone from Nigeria next to me and a girl from Ireland on the other side of me, and we hugged and kissed.
I love being an American, an African-American.
When I came to the United States, I was 19, and I think that was already too old to get the right accent.
I had to leave the country for political reasons.
If we go back to China, probably no chance to come out again.
We're not a melting pot. We're more like a tossed salad. And each ingredient in that salad gives the salad flavor.
Wherever you are, it doesn't matter. You always have one objective, serve the mankind.
Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly...
I don't remember it.
Through the dawn's early...
You know why? Because now I sing the National Negro Anthem. Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring, ring with the harmony.
One nation, under God.
Indivisible. What does it mean, indivisible?
To the Republic for which it falls.
Indivisible, liberty and justice for you.
For you.
What does that mean, that we're one nation and we're not divisible?
Is it just like saying there's one God?
That's how I kind of see it, for it's a prayer. And the part that I get disenchanted with is the liberty and justice for all.
I think it's something we've lived by. We did in World War II. We really believed all that stuff.
And then under God, the flag. Yeah. And I said, and to the Republic
for which
it
stands.
Nation indivisible with liberty and justice for all. It's poetic, you know? It has a rhythm. It has a cadence.
Some child somewhere is listening to those words and they're thinking about it. Maybe the next senator or president is thinking about it and saying, hey, I should make a difference. I should actually make this happen.
I
pledge allegiance
to the flag
of the United States of America
and to the republic
for which it stands,
one nation
under God,
indivisible,
with liberty
and justice,
with liberty
and justice,
with liberty and justice for all.
No actual fireworks were harmed during this performance of the Hearing Voices Pledge of Allegiance. Some of us think the best summer festivals are not the ones in town. We prefer the clothing-optional shindigs out in the woods, as in Woodstock or Burning Man. Barrett Golding takes us now to the annual gathering of the Rainbow Family.
I've decided to leave home, leave the world for a few days, and go into the woods. I'm going to join the Rainbow Family in the National Forest.
We're building our info center here. This is sort of where people come to find out what's happening, where camps are located. We have a Krishna camp, a Buddhist camp, a Jesus camp. We're going to have an Elvis camp.
They're expecting like 50,000 people. I know there's loads of people in these woods, though. And I've been going to these things since I was, like, 10 years old.
So your folks go to it?
Yeah, she's right there. It's my mom. I gotta go get food.
Okay, thanks.
Oh, she's hurt.
No, she just threw away one of Tara's cherished sticks again.
Don't be mean, second Maya, please.
The Rainbow Family gathers every year, the first week of July.
Remember your compassion card.
20,000 hippies are camping in Montana's Beaverhead Forest. On the highway, I pass peace signs on vans and flowers painted on buses. I pick up hitchhikers with long skirts and tie-dye shirts. We're about 100 miles from where I live. In time, though, we're not far from 1967.
The neat thing I like to think about is on the 4th of July. It's probably the only village like it in the whole United States. It's probably the only village where people are coming together under the vision of peace and love to make a statement for the whole world that the whole world can be what we are on the 4th of July. They can be that peaceful village.
You know, it seems like there's two kind of people up here. There's the people who come to party and then...
Well, those are the people that our family has invited to come. We invite all the people in the world. This is our family.
But there's a group of people that come and work.
Absolutely.
Well, yeah, it takes a lot of work to put a peaceful village together. Yeah. There's miles of water line. There's latrines for 20,000... There's
20,000 bellies to feed.
You know, there's kitchens, you know. And
now, I guess what I got to wonder is there like a little too much 60s nostalgia? I mean, you know, this guy's got a tie-dye T-shirt and everything and the Volkswagen vans. You know,
a
bunch
Cadillac
of people with something in their head that they're holding on to. Do you know what I mean?
What's wrong with that? If it's something worth holding on to, I mean, I went to Vietnam. I shot at people for a long, long time. And when I came back, I was wounded. I was wounded in my spirit. And when I found these people, they weren't talking about going out and creating war. They were talking about living peace. We are on the path to peace just by being here and doing this. And there's nothing wrong with holding on the best of every generation all throughout human civilization. Whatever was good from every generation, we should cherish that, make that part of us. And if the 60s was about peace and love and making the weapons plowshares, we should do that. So, you know, it could be a nostalgia thing, but to me it's not.
You know, beneath this tie-dye is a great-grandfather of Korea in World War II at the end of it. And I got 5 stalwart sons, and they pay huge taxes. We're not all poor, broke-up hippies. I'm not even a hippie. I'm a beatnik, because I'll be 70 next month. And I'd advise every great-grandfather in this country to come to this, because this is where we're hanging out. This is where the people are that believe in the right of the people to a peaceful assembly celebrating Independence Day in America. And we're independent of a strong federal government controlling every aspect of our life. And my family pays over $150,000 a year in income taxes.
An old logging road, jammed with traffic, goes up to a green meadow. To the west is a pine forest filled with tents and teepees. To the east, a grassy hill and several 9,000-foot peaks. The meadow is a mile long, a half mile wide, and constantly packed with people. They eat at free kitchens with names like Lovin' Ovens, Infinite Sunrise, Voodoo Soup. In the trade circle, they barter for beads, bongs, and bongos. They come to pray for peace, to sit in circles, shed their clothes, make music, smoke pot. Just like the 60s, everything seems possible, and nothing seems real.
I've been going to gatherings about 16 years. I got involved with all sorts of really kooky characters who showed me all sorts of stuff. Like, I ended up talking with lights in the sky. You can believe what you want. You don't have to accept this. You know what I'm saying? I am, like, skeptical philosopher from New York. Okay, but I've seen a lot of rainbows in the sky at high noon on July 4th over the silence of thousands and thousands of people. And I think one of the reasons that the rainbow gathering exists, and you can put this in your little pipe and smoke it, right, is that those rainbows are really powerful objects. They've been happening over and over again at our family gatherings, especially on July 4th. And I think the U.S. government, the reason why they don't shut us down is because they realize that's a lot of real power, and they might want to use it for military purposes. So instead of shutting us down, they let us continue forward to figure out what it is we're doing.
R&D for the government.
Exactly. We're like, we're spiritual R&D folks. Right? We're going to show them how to really bring the hammer of God down on their enemies. Okay, so like that's the main thing.
But the rainbow is a reminder to God that he will never kill us all, irregardless of how bad we get. And when Noah happened with the flood and everything, then God saw the rainbow and he said, I promise not to kill them again, even though they get really, really bad. Sodom and Gomorrah, the things that they were doing then by the archives and things, was nothing compared to the United States today.
But you got everything here. You got thieves, you got liars, you got rapists, you got people that are loving and benevolent and kind. Everybody from all over the world coming here. There's every good and bad thing you can dream of here.
There's some very strong Hebrew people, Hasidics, some really heavy-duty Jesus proselytizers camped all over here, and we have several varieties of Krishnas. In the evening, they're going to try and sit down and have a conversation. Now, it's very unlikely they're going to jump up and kill each other, as they do all over the world. In fact, they might actually communicate. But if they find out they can't tolerate each other, then they'll each go back to their separated camps at either end of the peaceable assembly, and they'll remain so. Well, to get down to the real truth of the matter is... Yes?
Can I have a sucker?
No. You've already had lots of candy today. I love you.
Night falls, the campfires light, and 1,000 instruments come out to play. I'm tired. As I unroll my sleeping bag, a beautiful young woman comes up. She asks if I have any warm socks. I'm from Montana, camping in the mountains. Of course I have extra socks. I reach in my pack and hand her a pair. She wanders back into the dark. The next morning, no one speaks at all. They meditate until noon, when every single soul is here in the meadow. This is July 4th, their day of prayer. Is this real? Are these people for real? They've built a community within America, but also without it. Tens of thousands live in the woods for a week, feeding themselves, filtering water, and burying feces. That's real. Some stay longer to clean up. A month from now, you'll hardly know they were here. On my way out, a few miles down the highway, a deputy sheriff pulls me over. Do you have any weapons? No. Do you have any drugs? No. He's just a kid, probably deputized for the week. He asks again, any weapons? Any drugs? I ask him. You get a lot of people answering yes to that. You catch a lot of criminals that way. Get out, he says. I'm searching your car. I don't want you to. You don't have a choice, he says. But I know the law. Probable cause, illegal search and seizure, which doesn't matter, because by this time, two state troopers have pulled up, hands on their guns, talking about officer safety. 10 miles away, 20,000 have gathered to pray for peace. Here in our little gathering, it's just three guys with guns bothering one guy with none. I'm back in the real world now. I'm back home.
Those Rainbow music recordings were made by Hawker. The guitarist is Don Ross. Although no actual guns were fired during Barrett Golding's visit with the Rainbow family, you can bet your boots guns are going off somewhere. Guns, grenades, rockets, heat-seeking missiles, all kinds of fireworks. Let's face it, summer is when we celebrate the Declaration of Independence, a.k.a. the Declaration of War. So, for producer Joe Frank, summer always raises the troubling question, which is better, war or peace?
So here's to the snappy salute, to spit and polish, the clicking of booted heels, the singing of martial oaths. Here's to the officer's club and the swaggering commandant, to the loving but abusive drill sergeant, to the constant flow of insult that is the philosopher's stone of survival. Here's to the young lieutenant fresh from the academy, to the troop ship, soldiers with their duffel bags slung over their shoulders, their cloth caps slouched and angled on their brows. And here's to weeping parents, sweethearts, and children clutching at the skirts of their mothers, to final tearful embraces and brass bands playing. Here's to the night before the battle, to the assault, the coursing landing craft, to going over the top, to the airborne troopers plunging from their droning seed pods, to the rubber dinghy landing at night. Here's to where the farm boy and the city dweller meet and are made equal. Here's to the arcing shell and magnesium dawn, to the clanking treads of armored personnel carriers, to bullets and howitzers, carbines and recoilless rifles, to mortars and anti-personnel bombs, to fragmentation grenades and tear gas canisters, to machine gun emplacements and flamethrowers, to phosgene and mustard gas, to the serrated bayonet and the deadly rain of shrapnel. Here's to minefields fraught with sudden fragmentation, to screaming Sergeant Death commanding the ragtag remnants of his courageous platoon. And here's to raising the flag on the shattered field of victory, to the prisoner of war camp, to the medevac chopper, the hospital ship, sacrosanct, yet sunk, to chaplains, to burial detail and body bags, to taps and other songs. And here's to the brave pilots who, in their cavalier ready rooms, prepare to become the airborne messengers of death, to the dog-faced infantry who dedicate themselves to the earth as much as their own cause. Here's to words like courage, sacrifice, discipline, glory, maimed, dead. Here's to war. I raise my glass to you and gaze into the roiling liquid of death's own intoxication. O war, you have made the low elevated, you have created heroes, and history will be written by your winner. Peace is pallid next to you. Peace can skulk and shrink, a weakling, a coward's paradise. Peace, you lukewarm bowl of grandmother's mush, you washed out stand-in for manly behavior. Peace walks through the marketplace offering second-hand bargains. Peace, the shaver of points, the cut-rate merchant. Peace, you miserable converter of men into swine, you destroyer of valor, quicksand in which nations founder, the bleeding wound in the side of the great avenging angel. peace, the apologist, the compromiser, the appeaser, the rust upon the edge of courage's great sword. What is peace but an excuse, a reason for cowardice, a refusal to accept one's responsibilities? I spit on peace. I lift my leg on peace. I have my dog to spoil the miserable garden of peace. There are no medals to peace, no honors, no marching bands, no great monuments to peace, no hymns sung, no great odes, no martial melodies, no parades to peace. There are no gigantic fireworks displays, no champagne corks popped to peace, no last cigarette smoked in its honor. There is no night before peace, no declaration of peace. The very absurdity of a nation declaring peace on another shocks the imagination. And who among us can say that he has heard of the spoils of peace? Is there such a thing as a peace hero? Who among us have gathered with his old cronies late at night, hoisted a glass, and told peace stories? What valiant young man has been welcomed back from peace? What young boy has gazed longingly at his father, saying that he would willingly go to peace to save his country?
That's an excerpt from Joe Frank's story, I'm Not Crazy. You can hear the whole thing at joefrank.com. Our summer radio special wouldn't be complete without a picnic and a parade. Both are coming up in a minute when we return with Stars and Bars from hearingvoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
Welcome back to Stars and Bars, a summer special from HearingVoices.com. Let's hit the road for a visit to a small town. What could be more American than summer in a small town? Even if it is, maybe, not the nicest small town in America. If you're driving across the Nevada desert on I-80... you could, halfway between Winnemucca and Elko, bump into the little town of Battle Mountain, population 3,000, mainly living in trailers. On a normal day, you could walk down the main street till you come to what looks like a cement plant. Actually, it's a barite mill, which has something to do with mining, the way everything has to do with mining around here. The mill makes a very interesting sound, don't you think? Now and then a car will go by. Down the street, there's a Shell station with a sign so tall, people can see it from the interstate. Occasionally, a total stranger will swoop into town to gas up. We haven't been to the gas station yet, have we? Do you want to check out the gas station? No? Not at all? Well, never mind. We're in luck, because today is not a normal day in Battle Mountain. This is a special weekend in August, when the town pulls itself together to celebrate being... the Armhead of America. That's right, the absolute worst, most dismal place to live in the whole country. A couple of years ago, a big newspaper on the East Coast held a contest. A lot of places were nominated for Armpit. East St. Louis, Fargo, Camden, the usual suspects. But a writer from the paper came out here, looked around, and I do believe what cinched it was the Shell station with that great big sign. The S had burned out.
We had some public that still wasn't quite sure what to think of it. They didn't really think being an armpit was exactly what they wanted to be.
Shar Peterson from the Chamber of Commerce.
It's a great tool to pull people off the interstate, and that's the problem Battle Mountain had had. They couldn't pull people off the interstate. They would zoom right on by to Winnemucca or Elko. And it takes something quirky anymore, as you well know. Same old thing every place you go, but if you have something different and quirky, it catches people's attention.
Take it off, let's go. Come on, ladies, let's get this going.
An armpit beauty contest. That's quirky, isn't it? You don't hardly get quirkier than that.
My name's Rick Wells. I'm from the northeast side of the state, and we are in the pit. Oh, it's kind of dumpy, isn't it? The houses and that. I've been in worse places. Up in Wyoming. Wamsutter, which is about 30 miles west of Rawlins on I-80. You know, this place beats it all to heck. At least it's got trees. Wamsutter doesn't have trees. I was just through there recently, and there's no trees in Wamsutter.
Rick is not here for the armpit festivities anyway. He's come for the team roping contest. Team roping is where a cow comes flying out of a chute, chased by two people on horses, and one of them tries to rope the horns, and the other gets the back end of the cow. This is just how they rope cows on a ranch, but here they do it with stopwatches and rules and regulations, and they do it over and over all day long. It's incredibly popular here. It's not just guys roping cows. There are women and kids and old folks. This is a family sport. Shirley Shepherd has been team roping with her husband for decades. She's kind of taken aback by the armpit festival thing.
Yeah, because Battle Mountain is not the armpit of America. You have to look and figure beauty's in the eye of the beholder. This town is a mining town. Mining town, boom, or they bust. And they do that all the time. You'll have 10 good years, and then you'll have 5 bad years. Then another mine will open up, and you'll have 10 more good years or 20 more good years, and then that mine goes down. And that is what Battle Mountain is. It'll never be anything different. And I don't think you can promote anything to change that. And I'm not really sure if you should try and promote tourism here. I think it'd be great if you can do one weekend of an event like this. But, I mean, to actually say Battle Mountain has something that people are going to come off the road and
and want to come visit? I don't know if they would or not. For you to drive by on the freeway and say, oh, that looks like a neat place. I don't know.
Shirley has to leave now because she's busy helping with the annual Basque picnic.
Plazer dut, balamantea ginik, eta ikusten dut, aizkide anitz hemen. I said, I enjoyed coming to Bottom Mountain and I seen a lot of my friends in here.
Paul Inchospa is a rancher in his late 70s. He runs cows and sheep on a spread about 60 miles to the south. He's come to town because this is where the Basque picnic happens every year, and he's astonished to discover the Armpit Festival.
I don't even like the name. So where the hell they... I didn't even know was anything like that here. I don't understand. I don't know what's going on there.
He may not care for the armpit label, but it doesn't sound like he cares a lot for the town either. After all, it's mining, and miners would be, from a rancher's point of view, a bit, you know, transient.
We don't get along with the mining people, really. They're not local people. They move a lot, you know, and it's all kind of people, see. And the mining, sometimes they're booming, you know. They high, some other times they go down. And then if they lose a job, they go someplace else, I guess. And that's what it is around here. There's hardly nothing here, really. Hardly nothing here. What? There's nothing.
Okay, first I'm going to put powder down the barrel. The powder measure is made out of the tip of a cow's horn. This is a round ball. When you put the round ball in, if you cast it yourself, it has a little spur on it, a little knob, and you make sure that that's facing up. Then you take your ramrod and force everything down the barrel. And tamp it a few times to make sure it's seated on the powder. Ready?
Kerry Tuckett is a mountain man. Well, he works for a gold mine, of course, and he and his family live in a trailer, of course, but it's a big trailer and full of mountain man paraphernalia.
There's an arrow that I made the arrowhead and took feathers from, I can't remember what they are, what are they? Goose feathers. A lance, kind of a ceremonial lance up there with some poor eagle imitation feathers. I've got a war bonnet that I made that's got real nice imitation eagle feathers on it. That's my hobby as a mountain man. Yeah. One of the biggest complaints that you hear from people is that it's boring to live in Battle Mountain. Well, I'd like to see boring. I'm so cockeyed busy that I can't hardly breathe sometimes. Like this morning, Josh was supposed to be at soccer practice at 6, and I woke up at 6, and so that's what I told the coach. I says, come on, it's my day off, and you're making me get up at 6. You know, our kids have always been busy. They've always been active in sports, in scouting, in the outdoors, and we've never, I can honestly say I don't think any of my kids have even tasted alcohol. They're just good kids. Can't complain a bit about them.
He's not complaining too much about the armpit thing either.
They've put that sign up there at the end of 305, you know, welcome to Battle Mountain, and they've gone in and put little pots with flowers around and, you know, kind of cleaned town up a little bit. What's his face that owns the Shell got his sign fixed so it doesn't say hell anymore. I mean, it's one of the first things you see. You come in at night and there's this big hell sign up there in the sky, you know. So, I don't know.
It's a 1980 Camaro body.
It has a 1970 Camaro chassis underneath. It has a Ford 9-inch rear end. The front end is a 1976.
Stacy Buehler, that's Stacy the Booger Man Buehler on the stock car racing circuit, is working at a gold mine, living in a trailer with his wife, Susan, their little girl, Synovia, and a lot of cars.
It's in your blood. Once you get it out racing into here, it's hard to get out of it.
If it wasn't that way, I wouldn't have so many junk cars sitting in this yard. He gets home from work, they go out in the garage, they work on the car, they go out to the racetrack. So basically, if I want to see him, I go out to the garage, otherwise I never see him. And the bad thing about race season is if anything's wrong with my car, I might as well hang it up. It took me 2 years to get a set of brakes on my car.
She does not think Battle Mountain is the armpit of America, however.
To know how we feel about it, ask yourself if it was your hometown, how would you feel? And granted, we have a lot of, most of our homes around here are like this when they're trailers. But when you work in a mining community, that's what you put in. You've got to be able to pack up and move. It would be pointless to have a town full of houses. Because then when you leave, you have to try and sell them. And when the price of gold's down, they're not selling. If gold ever plummets real bad, there will be nothing here. There'll be maybe a couple gas stations for truckers going through, and maybe the whorehouse down the street will stay in place, but that's going to be about it.
But till that day comes, if it does, Battle Mountain has one thing going for it. It is, for better and for worse, a small town.
I went to Chicago on vacation this spring, and driving there, I got stuck in some rush hour traffic. And Synovia wasn't feeling good. She gets a little motion sickness. And she started getting sick on me, and I was an hour and a half from the motel because of the rush hour, moving not even 5 miles an hour. The difference is, at least I can stop here in the desert and get her out of the car. You know, I like my small towns. It
depends where you grow up, I guess, where you're used to what you're used to.
So, yeah, we're small town, and we like it that way.
The sun is going down now, and it's time for the crowning event of the Armpit Festival, the parade. Really, this is the town's normal 4th of July parade, shifted over to an armpit theme. Some folks have draped their floats with fake hair. Others are just going with what they've got. There's a guy on a horse dressed like Santa Claus. A few kids have tied balloons to their dune buggies. Stacy Buehler has tacked a "Support Our Troops" sign on his Camaro. One woman has dressed her dogs up in funny hats. And then they're gone. Bit by bit, all over town, the lights go out, and stars come out over the desert, and the only sound is the humming of the barite mill. This is Hearing Voices. It's picnic time. Grab your apple pie, your brewskis, and your bottle rockets, and let's join producer Benjamin Adair on the farm of Otha Turner in Mississippi.
I could tell you how to get there, but that would only help. I could tell you, you fly into a town where they say the blues is in trouble, where they say all the younger set are going so heavily for the hip-hop, and it's hard, they say, to get people to support basic blues. You get into a car and you drive south. You go from a big road to a little road to an even smaller road, and just when you're about to give yourself up for lost, when you're looking around like you're in another country, you're there. Only you're not quite, because I can give you direction and you'll arrive at Otha Turner's picnic, the last of the great picnics. But that's really only half of what you need. Here, let me show you what I mean. You drive these roads and you get there early. You find Otha Turner's farm, see his house, which is not a trailer like the ones next door, but a house that stands in front of a pig pen and a caged, wailing hound dog and the spot where they'll kill, skin, and barbecue two goats in the morning. Behind the house, there's an older white man. He used to be a Mississippi Highway Patrolman, he tells you, and this is his first picnic, too. He's just gotten there. Just backed his huge Ford F-250 into Otha's yard and unloaded the pipes, the tarps, the rope to make a tent. Because no rain, Mr. Otha says, no rain is ever going to cancel a picnic. So you stand in the drizzle and you help assemble this tent and you try not to think about this state trooper, this good Samaritan, this man, this white lawman who may or may not have fought in America's second Civil War, who may or may not still be fighting. This man, this generous man, who will tell you in just a few hours to... Look at that woman over there. When the light hits her just right and you get her in just the right profile, doesn't she look exactly like Whoopi Goldberg? No, put that out of your mind. Move out from under the tent towards this other man, this black man with short white hair and a blue mesh cap. He's walking towards the overhang and he swaggers. He moves with the strength and confidence of a man who's worked the land hard his whole life. He's shaven, though... How he works the razor between those deep lines in his face is a mystery. He's got silver blue eyes, and when the light hits them just right and he's staring straight at you, they reflect. They look right through you. In a few seconds, he'll start telling you a story, and you'll start to believe everything you've heard about Otha Turner is true. Otha Turner, the last of the Fife Players. Otha Turner, former sharecropper. America's last living link to a culture that, like him at 94 years old, simply and stubbornly refuses to die.
He said, oh, I don't know if you'd be smart in the dusty. Do like your mama tell you I'll make it. Well, when? He said, you got to give me time. I'll make it. When I make it, I'm going to call you. I wish you'd make it. He's making. Going along the road. Come out, Otho. I run up there. He said, here's your price. I took a look at that. Thank you, thank you. What are you for? He said, nothing.
And then, about 17 seconds into this astounding story of how Otha Turner, living legend, first picked up an instrument, first learned how to play a fife, you realize you don't understand a single word he's saying.
Well, actually, my first memory of the picnic is when I was a little bitty boy. They took us over to see a picnic, but I remember being up on top of a hill sort of looking down on the picnic, and we watched Napoleon play and Otha Turner play and a bunch of other people. The picnic was very, very large, but it was totally black people at that time, and we were just sort of taken down there to watch it from the hill. That's what I remember. I was a real little bitty boy at that time. That's my first picnic.
Oh, man, you weren't even born. You weren't even born. That was way back in there. What? 40. And the first picnic I went to.
About 8 years old.
What do you remember about it?
The fife and drums, the music. Mostly when you're young, that's about the first thing catch your eye. The music.
And you were 8 years old and you were running around.
I wasn't running around. I was standing in the back of my daddy's pickup truck. We weren't allowed to run around because there were too many people there. And my mom didn't want us to get lost. We would get out and go get us a snowball or something like that and then go back to the truck. At that time, it was other.
Well, that's pleasure. That's pleasure. Folks work hard all the weekend, got nowhere to go, no enjoyment, see. All right. When they found out, I used to give nights of at night to play in the house, burning lamp with no electric light. And the people would come there and they liked it and they'd see that.
So at that time it was all black and then the whites were watching from up around?
Mostly. There were a few people that were down there sort of mixing in, but... Obviously, we were young children, and this was the 50s, and we just sort of were taken to go watch and listen to this unusual music that clearly then nobody ever heard anything like that in the white community, pretty much. So, yeah, it was much more segregated than it was.
What's the first image you have of American music? You have the fife and drum player with the little piece of string wrapped around his bleeding head, marching down the battlegrounds. And I mean, that military music was the first music that we really brought over here. What I've heard is that, the slaves, picked up on this military music, and it was a music that they could play, that their owners would allow them to play. And what they did, as usual, is make it even better, more soulful, and took on a whole new thing.
And according to Alan Lomax, this type of music is very popular in Senegal, where people make their own fife instrument out of bamboo in Senegal. A lot of the slaves who came to this area were from that area in Africa, number one. Number two, the slave owners and the slaves developed a very strong bond in this part of Mississippi, in that the slaves almost became a part of the family, and they were never sold. So you had people going back who lived here and played some of that type of music, and it just sort of stuck in this area because you had that strong tradition and that strong sense of community here.
I believe it was in 47, the first real picnic I remember my mama and them giving. We lived it down there in the Delta part of Mississippi. And my uncle, he come down there, and he played a little bit, and then there was some more people that come play drums. Hey, Freddie Brooks them and his brothers. Now, they used to have a good band. They all them people all died out. Man, there used to be a lot of people in here that played old music like that. So did.
Otha Turner and his rising star fife and drum band have two records. David Katznelson's the label exec. He says the music will get to you like it got to him. He says the music, it's transcendent, and when you first hear it, it sounds great, and the second time you hear it, it sounds great.
But then all of a sudden you start getting a need to hear it, and then when all of a sudden you hear the drums starting up, it's like, oh man, and then all of a sudden it opens up in this weird, great musical world, this wonderful place that's, I don't know, it transcends, you know, reality, which is, I'm sure, what they were doing at the very beginning.
Back in sharecropping days, the picnics were during the lay-by. That's after you've done all your planting and sowing and cultivating, when you just have to wait for the cotton or the corn to grow. So, nothing else to do. Why not have a party? Why not invite everybody from everywhere? Why not bang on that big bass drum, which in the days before all this noise we're so used to now, you could hear for miles? Oh, the Turner says the picnics were competitive. You'd throw one, and then I'd throw one, and mine better be better than yours. These days, however, Otha Turner takes first prize every time because, just like he's got the last fife and drum band, he also has the last picnic.
This is the only one left because most of the other people have died out and or in nursing homes or disabled to do it, and so Dad is the only one that still does it.
The picnics are bigger now. There are more musicians. It's not just fife and drum music, but North Mississippi blues. And more guests, more visitors, more tourists come too. The purists will tell you that it's getting too big, that the 200 people crammed in between Otha Turner's house and the pig pen, about half from out of town, those are mostly white, and the rest from around the area, mostly black. The so-called purists will tell you that it's getting diluted. But like the college girl who threatened to trip me if I didn't have Otha's permission to record, most of the so-called purists are at their first or second picnic themselves, and more than that, most of these complainers aren't even dancing.
What are your favorite parts about the picnic?
Gosh, I only get goat once a year. And, to see some of the faces, the same faces that come back year after year after year. And it kind of seems like family. You know, we all grow closer. I think it's a kind of like a reunion thing. You got people that want to come every year to this, you know, this particular event at this time, you know. And it really touches my heart because some of them leave here, we never hear from them. But a lot of them will write me a little postcard and tell me how much they enjoyed it and, you know, stuff like that. And that really is kind of, it touches you.
I mean, there's just a bunch of people getting together and hanging out, and everybody here has one common love, which is music, and the other common love, which is just camaraderie and hanging out. And it's truly an egalitarian space in that sense.
But, you know, every day is a new thing. And, like, you know, Richard Johnson's setting up right now, and he's a great player. Luther's going to be coming down. He's great. I mean, last year it was like R.L. Burnside and T-Model Ford. And this last night had a bunch of the Burnside, you know, sons and grandsons. And it's amazing because one guy wrote about 3 or 4 months ago how the blues is dying in this part of the world when, in fact, there is players galore, and all you need to do is come to the picnic, honestly.
For the enjoyment. A picnic just like a family union.
family union people come for in you. And you're having all the fun you want and all the music ain't nothing else to you. You ain't got to worry about nothing else.
And what you realize after spending a couple of hours at Otha Turner's picnic, as I recommend everyone do, after you've eaten some of the barbecue goat or pork and talked with Jim and seen how everyone seems to pick on Chip, but that's okay because once Chip starts singing, after you've drunk a few beers and maybe some of that Mississippi moonshine, after you let go of your notions of who belongs and who doesn't, and you even see that state trooper dancing over there with his son. He's fetched him from home so as not to miss this. After a couple of hours, two things happen. First, you start to understand Otha. So you know what he means when he says something that you can do and the people like it. I think it's low-down aggravating. You don't do it.
See, that's where I see it. It's like you want me to hear me blow that can and I know I can play and you ask me to do it and I sit there and look at it, you wouldn't do it. That's low down. So that's the way I hear. And that's what I believe in.
Second, you figure out that here, in the middle of nowhere, Mississippi, the sons and daughters of those sons and daughters of former slaves and slave owners have figured something out. Here, there's a rhythm to life and pleasure and, as Otha Turner himself puts it, to the enjoyment that seeps in underneath. That gets to you. And the first time you feel it, you think it's great. The second time you feel it, you think it's great. But what you get by going to Otha Turner's picnic is that third time, when the drums come in and it's like, oh man. Somewhere near Senatobia, Mississippi, on the edge of the hill country. I'm Benjamin Adair.
Benjamin Adair tells us Otha Turner died in February of 2003, at age 94, his parties still live on. For links to all the producers and the music heard in this special, visit hearingvoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. And the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of SoundImagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is HearingVoices.com.